Haunted Nights, live with Tamara Thorne and Alistair Cross.
I'd like to thank W.J. Pierce for creating and performing our music. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Thorn and Cross Haunted Nights Live. We're your hosts. I'm Alistair Cross, and I'm here with my co-host and collaborator, Tamara Thorne. Thank you for joining us. Before we introduce tonight's guest, I'm going to turn it over to Tamara, who's going to tell you a little bit about what we're working on now.
Yeah, well, we've got a pair of solo novels that are in the final stages of production, and they'll be available very soon. My novel is Brimstone. It's a coming-of-age story that takes place in 1968 in a little town called Brimstone in Arizona. The Brimstone Grand Hotel, owned by reclusive former movie star Delilah Devine, looms high on Hospital Hill, harboring long-buried family secrets that whisper of unimaginable horrors. Horrors that will echo down through generations. Within the walls of the Brimstone Grand, the past has come back to life, and Holly Tremaine and her grandmother Delilah are faced with an ancient familial evil that reaches just below the old hotel's serene facade, an evil that won't rest until it possesses Holly, body, mind, and soul. And Alistair's new release, it's The Silver Dagger. It's book two in the Vampires of Crimson Cove series, and it picks up with the first book, The Crimson Corset, leaves off. Life in Crimson Cove has been good to the Coulter brothers since Gretchen Van Treese was staked and her horde of vampires scattered. But when she rises from the grave, the brothers are torn apart, their lives and the peace between them shattered. Meanwhile, a serial killer is stalking the little mountain town, leaving a trail of blood that leads to a truth Sheriff Ethan Hunter doesn't want to face. The streets are no longer safe, nor are the forested paths, for a new and unknowable evil has come to Crimson Cove, and everyone, vampire and human alike, must come together in order to survive. Alistair.
All right, and again, the first book in the Crimson Cove series is called The Crimson Corset, and that is available at Amazon.com. And if you're a vampire fan, you might also want to check out its companion novel, Darling Girls. That's a Thorn and Cross collaboration that features vampires from my Crimson Cove series as well as vampires from Tamara's novel Candle Bay. All right, very quickly, again, you're listening to Thorn and Cross Haunted Nights Live. You can learn more about what we do at our websites, alistaircross.com or tamarathorne.com. You can visit our mutual blog at thornandcross.wordpress.com. If you tweet, our handles are at crossalistair and at tamarathorne. You can also visit our Haunted Nights Live page on Facebook. For more information on the show, you can visit Authors on the Air on Facebook, Twitter, and at authorsontheair.com. This is a broadcast of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. All right, tonight we are thrilled to have the return of one of our favorite guests, Daniel Ferens. He's a director, producer, and writer known for The Haunting in Connecticut, Halloween 6, and The Amityville Murders. His new movie, The Haunting of Sharon Tate, opens tomorrow and is receiving rave reviews, and Dan has come back to tell us all about it. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Dan, and congratulations on the new release.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks, guys, for having me back. How are you?
Oh,
good,
great.
Good.
How are you holding up?
Yeah.
Oh, pretty good. You know, it's been a busy time, but really excited about, obviously, the release of this movie and just been, you know, busy, so it's been good.
Well, we've seen the movie, and we both loved it. We really enjoyed it. This is a great horror movie, and it's different, and we like the difference. And you want to tell us about it a little bit?
Oh, sure. Yeah, thank you, first of all. Thank you for seeing it and for your kind response. Yeah, you know, it's tricky because we're taking, you know, an infamous true crime, you know, the Tate murders, say Tate, but it was, you know, five people, and her unborn child. I mean, probably the most controversial, horrifying, true life, you know, murder case of our generation, at least, or, you know, now 50 years, it's hard to imagine. It's been so long, but it's, it's the one that I feel like really gets people in the gut. Even though it's been half a century, it's hard to comprehend that kind of evil and, you know, and the senselessness behind the crime and, you know, Charles Manson being as infamous as he became, and his cult members. But, so we're grafting that onto, you know, almost a, you know, a fantastical, fictional recreation of it. And I did that very specifically because I didn't want to, I don't know, tread too much on that true story the way that it really happened. Uh-huh. You know, it would have been sort of the easy yeah. version would have been to do the bio kind of pick, true life, you know, recreation of it moment to moment. And I just wasn't as interested in that. I mean, the story of Charles Manson and his death cult has been done, pardon the pun, to death. And I just wasn't interested in telling that story again. I feel like yeah. there's nothing new to mine there for myself. Mm-hmm. But what I was interested in was, you know, who Sharon Tate was, who she might have been, what I thought she would have been like as a person. And the biggest part for me was to try to tell a version of the story that it's so hopeless, it's so dark, it's so troubling, where I could somehow find a way to turn the tables and empower these helpless victims. So that was okay. my approach to it.
And that was one of the things that I really liked about it. I think we both did.
Yeah.
We really commented on that when we were watching it. Is it's I think it's definitely obviously a touchy thing because it's real life and there are people still alive today who are close to the victims. But you gave them mm-hmm. You empowered them, and that's really cool. I respect that you did that. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
It's, you know, I think it's funny. It's a mixed bag. I think some of the, you know, mainstream press have, you know, really beaten the movie up because just for any reason that they could, you know, the fact that we're treading mm-hmm. on this kind of holy ground, if you will, it's just too much for some people. They can't sort of reconcile telling that story, but within the framework of a scary movie, you
yeah.
know, with the tropes of a scary movie, you open the refrigerator and the ice falls and it's a spook, you know. But what all of that was a couple of things. It was obviously setting up a scenario in which, you know, Sharon Tate, who I thought was beautifully played by Hilary Duff, mm-hmm. was feeling like she was the fish out of water. She had been in true story, you know, that she had been away from this house for over 6 months. She'd been in Europe. She and Roman Polanski, her husband, hadn't lived there very long. I think maybe a month before they were called away to these individual projects they had going on in Europe. So they had rented this house and they loved it, but they barely settled in when they were called out of town. So I wanted to impart that sense that this is almost like her first night ever in the house. You know, it's like you've been away that long. You've got
yeah.
not strange. You've got friends in the house, but you're, you know, there's something you want to impart that distance or that uncomfortable, that unsettled feeling that she had. So, you know, some of the creaks of the house and what have you are just to impart to the audience and, you know, to show that Sharon Tate was not, really probably wasn't very comfortable in her own little love house, as she called it. Just that
uh-huh.
feeling of being a little vulnerable, you know, you're 8.5 months pregnant, your husband's not with you, you've got friends around
yeah.
you, but it's not the same, you know, it's not what you would
sure.
expect it to be in that situation. Anyway, but, I, you know, and also, you know, she had the opportunity to go and have the baby, and I think Polanski wanted her to have the baby at a clinic in Europe, you know, kind of like a resort for the stars, and she decided no, she wanted to go home to Los Angeles and try to be closer to her friends and her family and have the baby here. Fateful decision, obviously, but that's how it really happened. And anyway, but my telling of the story is, you know, it's not in any way, shape, or form intended to be like, here's what happened the day she drove up to the house and came home. That's
right,
not
right,
at all.
Right.
Like, without giving it away,
yeah.
which maybe I can at this point, people will have seen it, but the whole movie is is set in purgatory. There's not a moment in the movie that's not, you know, in the realm of fantasy until the very, very end.
Right.
So we're really experiencing the movie through the spirits of these characters. I mean, if you watch the movie closely, you'll see that there is no one in the world except for them, you know, and they're in this little hideaway house up, you know, above the lights of Los Angeles, which was beautiful. But and it's interesting too.
It's beautifully shot.
The name of the street, Cielo Drive. Cielo actually in Spanish means heaven. So the first thing that Hilary Duff's Sharon Tate says as they drive up to the house is, "Did you know that Cielo means heaven in Spanish?" And you know, that is the clue, the first clue I gave to the audience that this is not reality. You're in purgatory. You're in limbo with these characters. This is the murder. When the movie starts, the murders have already happened. They've already died. They're just re-experiencing this trauma, this event, in a spiritual dimension. You know, and as such, they're able to make very different decisions than they did in reality. And I think that becomes the backbone of the story, of the question of, if we make different decisions, how can we change the outcome?
Right.
It's fascinating. And I it comes out tomorrow. It's The Haunting of Sharon Tate. And I'm curious as to, we all know, those of us in any kind of horror business know that, you know, the mainstream, they're never kind to horror of any kind. You could have done
they don't get it.
Anything with this movie. You could have done anything with it. And there's going to be those, you know how it is.
Idiot.
So I'm curious how,
we don't make these movies. You guys don't write these kinds of books for critics. You know, you kind of can't. You have to be a little bolder than that. And, you know, and if a horror movie doesn't disturb people, then you haven't really done your job. So, if they want to say I'm twisted and then I'm a schlockmeister or whatever, I guess that's better than saying that it was an ultimate failure, didn't scare them and didn't disturb them. So
we found it quite scary, but we love horror, both of us. And it was scary. While we were watching it together.
And
we had a great time. This was a good horror movie.
It really was. We really liked it. Yeah. I think anybody who likes horror is really, really going to like it. And you know, hey, no matter what they say, at least they're saying something, right?
They're saying something. Yeah, it's true. But I will say, you know, I'm not to say that all the reviews have been terrible. I think it's more the mainstream. You know, you're looking at your Variety and Hollywood Reporter and they haven't all done that yet. But the bigger ones have really kind of, you know, kicked.
These are people who don't know
it,
horror.
Said, no, this is
maybe they don't even know what horror is really supposed to be. Yeah.
I think they're used to, you know, reviewing now, you know, in this world that we're in. It's, you know, everything is very glossy. It's like The Conjuring. It's you know, it's these very big budget, very, you know, mainstream horror films that you know, it's like you're adapting Stephen King or James Wan, you know, and this very, very like, I don't know, the word is mainstream, you know, Jordan Peele's new movie, Us, you know, I feel like they review movies that are, you know, there has to be that element of the fantastic. And it's funny to me how many people have missed, you know, on first viewing, the idea that there's a spiritual sort of play going on with this one. I think they become so myopically focused on, oh, you know, it said August 8th, you know, on the title. So they take the movie very literally, and it's not literal. It's not ever intended to be the literal retelling of the Sharon Tate, you know, final days and all of that.
Not at all.
I couldn't, you know, in a weird way, in good conscience, I couldn't do it. The real story, because there's no redemption in any of it, and I looked for in some small measure some form of redemption with this movie, and I think that for me, and I think for the cast, anybody who got involved in the movie, was what made the thing. You know, we felt justified in making this version because it empowered those characters, you know, those people, the real people that were playing it.
Right.
There was something powerful, palatable about giving the power back to them. And that's how we did it. That's how we approached it. And we you know, worked super hard on this movie. It was shot over a period of, like, I think it was 15 days total that we had to make it.
Oh, wow.
Hilary Duff was not available for very long. She was on a little hiatus from her TV show, which is done in New York.
Uh-huh.
But she really liked this project. She wanted to do it. And so we had to accommodate her. And you guys have seen the movie. The whole movie rests on Hillary's back. You know, she had to carry every scene of the movie. So it was a daunting task for her. And I actually have to give her a lot of credit. She was really brave to take this on, and very, very professional. She knew all her lines. She was always on time. She was always right there, like, kind of very, very focused on getting this done. So I really,
and she did an excellent job. I mean, if you think about how hard it must be to be, I mean, at least the behind the scenes people get to be kind of behind the scenes, so to speak. But when I first heard that that you were doing this, I thought, wow, who's going to play Sharon Tate? And when I saw Hilary Duff, I thought, that's interesting. And then when I saw her do it, you know, because I was really surprised, not because there was any reason why I should have thought she couldn't do it, but I'm just like, it's Sharon Tate, and she did an excellent job. She really did, and I commend her for it, because what a way to step outside of, you know, I don't know, to take on something daring.
Right.
I respect any actress that you know, or writer for that matter, who does something daring. It's that's what makes stuff move.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a big change. You know, we were all stepping out of our, you know, listen, I had done, you know, Halloween movies and Amityville movies. All of those things are great, but this really was something more audacious. You know, I think that's the word, to try to tell this story, but in this very different alternate universe. But it's not so much an alternate universe as it is sort of, like I said, sort of this limbo, you know, that these spiritual beings are trapped in. And I thought, what an interesting notion. You know, we all question what's waiting for us on the other side, you know, when we think of the white light and the, you know, heavenly, you know, beings and angels and things. But what if it was just, you know, especially something where, like, this story sort of tackles, which is this horrifying, traumatic, senseless end to your life, and how, as a spiritual being, and when you can't even comprehend that, and if your soul goes on, how do you work that out in the afterlife?
Right.
And that was sort of an interesting question, I thought. And I thought, well, if you have to go back and you know, and relive that, or you have to come to terms with it in some way, that's where this began, which was that notion of how would they have been able to come to terms. That's exactly it. How would they come to terms with their own senseless deaths? And that was the beginning of the story.
Right, exactly.
Of how I...
Wow.
Well, I think fans of horror are going to love it. I really do. It's fantastic.
Yeah. But I want to ask about the area. Did you? You're so good at, you know, documentaries and things about Amityville and all the other things. Did you go out and visit the site of the house at Thalia Drive, and what did it feel like? If you did.
Oh well, the real house has been raised. It was torn down in the 90s. It doesn't exist. They have built this massive, you know, kind of like, I don't know, McMansion up there. it's not the same property at all. So we, you know, I actually put my location scout hat on for this because I was pretty, you know, much like Amityville, I felt like the house is as much a part of the story as the character. So given the fact that we didn't have the real house to even consider, more, I think we would have probably shot in it or been able to if it was around. But, you know, I wanted a reasonable facsimile of the house to give the impression of it. So I started, you know, I knew we were going to shoot in Los Angeles, and I knew what the schedule was going to be. So, you know, with that in mind, I started kind of scouting myself, and I found actually two houses that I really kind of fell in love with. The first one is in Runyon Canyon, and it's got this, you know, Airstream trailer that's part of the property, and that amazing, you know, ledge, you know, that overlook, like kind of looking upon the Hollywood sign and Griffith Observatory, and you can see all the way downtown. And I mean, it's just an incredible panoramic view of Los Angeles, which was very similar to the Real House, you know, but that's what they would have. So that house, and in the interior of the house was very similar. It had the rafters up in the living room. It had that very kind of low space, that low ceiling, kind of almost similar sort of claustrophobic feel to it. So, and the pool that was shaped exactly the way her pool was. The front of the house didn't work for me, so I looked for something else. And interestingly, I found this house in Laurel Canyon that was designed by the same architect that had designed Sharon Tate's CeeLo Drive house. And it was, you guys have seen the movie, the bones of it were essentially the same house. The window frames, the little door with the little Dutch door on it. The garage was actually almost an exact replica of the garage at that house, of the Real House. So we used that for the front of the house. And we had to sort of attempt to seamlessly sort of give the impression that we're in one location. I think we kind of pulled it off, but there were two different homes, and it was interesting that, you know, again, that the same architect had designed that. So I remember being on that location and really feeling like, oh wow, you know, this is what her garage looked like, you know, and you could feel it, you'd stand right in front of it. So it was interesting. But being up at that other house where you could kind of look up on the city, and we used for all the other interiors of the house as well, was magical in a sense. You know, you felt it's so peaceful up there and it's so quiet. It's hard to imagine the kind of horror that went on, you know, that horrible night.
Right.
And that they would have invaded such a private, such a, you know, tranquil, peaceful place. You know, Sharon Tate really called it her love house. That's what she called that place. And she looked at it as her, you know, private sanctuary in a way. And I think that just makes it even more horrifying that it was, you know, invaded so brutally. Yeah. Anyhow,
it does. I'd like to ask you a question. It's not exactly about the movie, but it's about the case, and it's just, I'd like your opinion on something. And if you don't want to answer it, just say I'll pass and we'll move on. I'm just curious.
Oh, no.
There are two remaining Manson girls, Leslie Van Houten and I believe Patricia Krenwinkel. Do you believe, just in your opinion, that they are, and they're both appealing to get out, and they were, I think, 16 or 17 when this all happened, I believe. Are you of the opinion that they are where they belong and they should stay where they belong, or are you of the opinion that people change and they were young?
Oh, I think it's fine that they have changed and done good for the other inmates and found God and what have you. It'll never take away what they did. I don't think that anyone would ever feel safe with them walking the streets. Just the idea of it is almost incomprehensible. And I feel like, you know, I'll echo what the Tate family, and not that it's my place to do so, but I think that their position is that when you can bring Sharon and those other victims back, then you should get out. But then until that day ever happens, then stay where you are. It brings up all these questions about, you know, we're in this middle of this, you know, upheaval in this country about incarcerations and people receiving, you know, 20-year sentences for, you know, marijuana, you know, arrests.
right.
I think the idea of jail, in my opinion, the people that should be in jail are those that we feel threatened by, that we feel are a threat to our safety.
Yeah.
that's where those people belong, because as a society, we can't have, you know, people who have the potential to cause, you know, other people physical harm running around. Murders of, you know, I do sometimes, I think about people, you know, who in a moment of passion, you know, something happens and they snap and they kill someone. It's hard. It's difficult because you sort of think about, you know, do we all have the potential to kind of like lose it in a moment and, oh my God, you know, I fired the gun.
Oh, right, right.
Pushed them off the,
yeah.
You know, I think everybody's had moments in their lives where their tempers, their emotions take over for that fraction of a second and something terrible happens. And those are the ones, the situations where I do wonder, you know, is that the right choice? But I think that's one of the things we just grapple with as a society. But my feeling is that those people are exactly where they need to be, and I don't think that society would be benefited in any way by having them released. And I think
because this was heinousness totally premeditated.
Those crimes, yeah, it was exactly. And whether or not they were under the spell of a cult, you know, it's all of that sort of inconsequential. They were a part of it. They participated in it. They terrorized these people, brutalized these people. It's not that there isn't forgiveness, but there's also not that sense for me of that it wouldn't be. There's nothing to be gained to having them released into society again. And I sympathize deeply, and maybe people would think not because of the movie that I made, with the victims' families and what they have probably endured for 50 years now, you know, and how it must have just changed them so fundamentally as people.
Oh, absolutely.
And made life a lot less joyful for any of these people. So I just find my heart goes out to all of the family members and friends of all of these people.
Right.
So that's true of any violent crime. I mean, it's not just, you know, this one's infamous. There's every day somebody loses a loved one to a horrible act of violence. You know, there's not a day you can open a newspaper or newspapers anymore, but look at the internet, turn on the news.
Exactly.
You know, somebody was struck down in a terrible way. Anyhow, so it's bigger and bigger as you think of it. It's really sad.
Yeah.
All
but
right. Well,
I think
before we let you go, can you tell us a little bit, if you're able to, you wrapped something up pretty cool yesterday. Can you talk about that for a minute or two?
I can't. There's not too much to tell just yet because we don't have a release date for it. But it's a movie that explores the last days of Nicole Brown Simpson and her life. It's interesting how these movies have kind of come one after the other to me.
Yeah.
This one in particular, I didn't write it, but I'm not the writer of it, but I'm a director and one of the producers, same group of producers as these last two films, Amityville and Santee. You know, it was an interesting notion of that attracted all of us to this project, which was that, and certainly without exonerating the real killer, I think we all know who that was, but there was an interesting relationship that Nicole had in the month or so before she had been killed. She had hired a man, this is supposedly, I believe this part of it is true, and the rest of it is, you know, it's only supposition because we don't know how this all played out in reality, but Nicole Simpson had hired a man to paint her condo on Bundy Drive. She'd only lived there for about 6 months, but she wanted it painted. She was doing some work on it. She hired a man. His name was Glenn Rogers. And it was later discovered that Glenn Rogers was actually a nationwide serial killer.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. And he has this, you know, he took the, you know, he claimed that he was put up to committing the murders by OJ. He had confessed to his brother. There was actually an interesting documentary
find it, called My Brother, the Serial Killer. And it is about Glenn Rogers, and it's about the murders he committed. They called him the cross-country killer, or the Casanova killer. And he would sort of seduce these women and then, you know, terribly and horribly murder them. He claimed to have killed as many as, I think, 70 people. I think he was convicted
wow.
of 5 murders across the country. So between Los Angeles and, I want to say, Florida, he had murdered, sort of left the swab of blood. But, yeah, the scary kind of adjunct to the story is that he was the guy that painted Nicole's condo. So the movie sort of explores that
yeah.
relationship, that idea. Mina Suvari is playing Nicole, and she did a great job. And it's
oh, nice.
Yeah, it's disturbing. Sort of not alternate reality, but I think it's just a little known part of the story. Again,
that's great. I love her. You get the best people for these.
Wife.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, she's great. She's great. She's lovely to work with. And again, I these people who approach these, you know, real life, you know, kind of larger than life characters, if you will, or iconic people, and to play them, I think it's pretty brave. You know, I have to give, you know, Hilary Duff and Mina Suvari a lot of credit. I think they're brave actresses, and I respect them greatly.
I agree. And
that's
thank
great.
You for doing these movies. These are fantastic
mm-hmm.
movies.
Since we
had you on the first time, I've gone back and I've watched probably all of your movies. I really like your style.
Yeah.
I really like what you do, and I feel like you are in many ways keeping horror alive. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Thanks.
Yes,
yes, I appreciate
yeah.
that. Thank you. Well, you as well. I mean, they're so prolific, the two of you. It's always a new book.
We keep trying.
So mutual admiration society here.
All right.
It turned out, thank you for thinking of me. Thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it very much. And I will keep you posted on new developments.
Yes,
please do. And we'd love to have you back.
We'll have you back.
Talk about the old days.
Yep.
Yeah.
That would be
yep.
that would be great. I'd love that. So thanks to both of you.
Okay.
All right.
Thank
and
you,
just a reminder
a
to
one.
The listeners, the Haunting of Sharon Tate comes out tomorrow. We've seen it. We love it. We think you'll love it too. So check it out. The Haunting of Sharon Tate out tomorrow. All right, Dan, thank you for being on. Thank you everybody for listening. Until next week, we wish you haunted nights.
And sweet screams.
Thank you for listening.
Haunted Nights, live with Tamara Thorne and Alistair Cross.